Hello, and welcome to episode 65 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Cancel culture roared onto the scene in the past few years, much to the delight of some and to the dismay of many others. And like many things in our society, social media has played an important role in how this phenomenon plays out in our modern world. There are many examples of someone being canceled, but the one I wanted to begin our conversation about today is the recent news from the National Hockey League. Here's the report from National Public Radio. The Boston Bruins have canceled plans to add defenseman Mitchell Miller to its organization after current players and NHL officials spoke out against Miller, who was convicted of bullying a black classmate with developmental disabilities back when he was 14. Miller has said he apologized and has portrayed his actions as a single incident, but critics of Miller, who is now 20, say he hasn't done enough to show remorse for his actions or to prove he's now a changed person. His victim has described systematic abuse that went on for years. Rick, I think we can agree that it's important to hold people accountable for their actions, but can't we also take things too far?
Yes, and when we engage in mob rule, we almost always do take things too far because there's no proportionality in the mind of the mob. And that's basically what cancel culture is. It's a group of people getting together and deciding to, you know, unify their voices to bring some kind of punishment on somebody for some action that's deemed socially unacceptable.
And in the case of this NHL player, this really, you know, changed a lot of things about this young man's life. I mean, he could have been who knows? He could have had an injury the next day and never made the NHL at all. But I mean, by all accounts, he had a bright career ahead of him, and this just put the brakes on that.
Yeah, and as far as I know, he still has a contract with the Boston Bruins, so he's probably going to make some money, but at least for the foreseeable future, he's not going to be playing hockey. So here's the thing. So he engaged in some really awful behavior 6 years ago when he was 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents of this classmate that he taunted and abused say that this behavior started in like first or second grade. So it went on for a number of years. But none of the professional sports leagues, as far as I know, have any rules governing what kind of conduct is acceptable for middle school or high school or even high school, but especially like elementary and middle school kids. So even if somebody engages in behavior that we would consider really bad as an adult. Can you imagine if they would institute a rule and say, like, if we detect like any credible accounts of abusive behavior, bullying when you were a middle schooler, you're going to be ineligible for this league? I would guess they would have to probably ban half the hockey players currently on the teams.
And I imagine, too, that you're not just picking on hockey players. This could be sort of expanded to a lot of people, not only in professional sports, but just in our everyday lives.
Even if you look at the accounts of the abuse that Miller engaged in, the accounts include many other kids on the bus doing the same thing. And so do we want to have a policy that says, okay, if you engage in bullying in school, you are ineligible to get a job?
Mm-hmm.
Right, or any kind of job with any kind of public profile. I mean, that would just be ludicrous. And this is why cancel culture as a form of mob rule is so dangerous to society. I mean, we do it because we don't trust our institutions to protect people the way they should. And there's some good reason for that. Institutions often fail us. The good thing about institutions is that they have rules and procedures. There's a kind of proportionality. There's due process. There's guidelines. None of that holds in the case of cancel culture.
I want to take this apart two different ways, but let's stay on this Mitchell Miller case for a moment. You know, this happened middle school time, maybe he was 14, and let's say he, it's hard to look into his heart, but we'll just pretend for a moment that he truly is remorseful and sorry about this. And it's probably hard to separate the sorriness quotient based, you know, because there's this professional hockey career staring him in the face, and he knows that that's at risk. But if he truly does feel this remorse, is there a way, and if you knew him somehow, is there a way that you would maybe counsel him to say, here's how to be your most authentic self about this, to really demonstrate to people who are very skeptical that you regret this in the strongest possible way?
No, there's no way to do it. And this is the problem. And we've seen this over and over again. When Will Smith tried to apologize to Chris Rock, you know, he did a very simple direct apology immediately after that was rejected. That's insincere. He doesn't really mean it. It's just simple. He just said it because he had to. And then later this summer, he engages in a really long, extensive apology. That's also dismissed as being faked and manufactured just for public consumption. There's nothing really someone can do that will overcome or show true remorse, because you can't judge from a person's behavior that you don't know whether they are being sincere. You can often tell this when you have a relationship with somebody, and we often do. We can tell by not just what they say one time, but how they act afterwards. You know, we can tell if somebody's being sincere. But you can't judge that on social media. You can't judge it in the case of a stranger.
And the other way I wanted to take this is Mitchell Miller, in this case, as I said, was 14. Let's set him aside for a moment. You mentioned the Will Smith, Chris Rock incident at the Oscars. I guess that was earlier this year. And Will Smith is certainly not 14. He's a grown adult. And there are and I think more often than not, this does happen when people are out of their teens into their adulthood. And does that change the calculus for you a little bit as far as the responsibility people have for their actions? Because to me, it seems like we can all think of dumb things we did when we were 14. And I think a lot of us have maybe less forgiveness for doing similar dumb things when we're in our 30s.
Yeah, we know, especially with boys, their brains aren't fully developed. They're much more susceptible to peer pressure. They're more likely to do dumb things when they're young, especially, you know, before age 21, 22. So it you don't really know a whole lot about an adult's character based on behaviors that they participated in when they were 7 or 8 or 10 or 14. On the other hand, you can tell some things. I mean, if this Mitchell Miller was engaging in repeated acts of harassment and bullying for many years, he probably grew up to be kind of a nasty person later on too. I mean, that's a pretty, I mean, you could make that generalization. I'm not saying I know that about
him. But that's a solid signal, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's a pretty good indication, unless something different happens sometime in life to make a real change of heart. And yet, we do become more responsible. We come later on in life. We might not have a change of heart, but we come to see that our actions have some kinds of consequences and we need to control them more. And of course, peer pressure is very different as an adult than as a child. I mean, lots of times that kind of really awful behavior is encouraged by others when we're in middle school, but discouraged when we get into our 20s and 30s.
You know, as I was preparing for the show, I guess I had forgotten in some ways how relatively new a phenomenon cancel culture is. I mean, it's not been around really much more than, I guess, 10 years at the longest. And obviously, it sounds like it got a little more propulsion during the Me Too movement, as a lot of these really pretty horrific stories at times came out about actions of powerful men, thinking, you know, Harvey Weinstein, but one of maybe the worst examples out there. But just taking Harvey, I guess, for a moment, not only what he did was ethically wrong, he's sitting in a prison cell right now. So that's a step quite a bit further. But even if he somehow managed to dodge prison time, do you think actions like that do deserve harsher punishment in the public square, meaning that I think I hear you say that you're somewhat skeptical of cancel culture in some cases, but I would say too that there are some acts, especially you know if they're repeated again and again and again, that do seem like ostracizing someone from polite society seems perfectly fine to me.
So the problem with cancel culture is as I said, it's a form of mod rule. It's arbitrary. There is no due process. There's no guidelines. There's no proportionality to it. On the other hand, when our institutions fail to ensure what we see as just responses to somebody's wrongdoing, and especially when there's like important omissions in the administration of justice in some area of our institutions, social media can be a really effective tool for saying, let's all come together and make sure that changes take place. We saw this happen with the Me Too.
Yeah,
movement.
I mean, people who we probably all know came forward and truly said Me Too. This was and told a story that they'd probably had it told much except to their closest friends and shared in public ways about how this these issues have affected them.
But for every Harvey Weinstein, there was also people that maybe did something one time incidentally or were even falsely accused.
Mm-hmm.
And they might have been falsely accused by somebody who had something out for them, but it was their actions were described in such a way that you couldn't help but be disgusted by the description. And then they were punished as well. And this is the problem with it, is that with the lack of due process, There's no rules for what counts as acceptable evidence, who has standing in a case, who can offer testimony, and whether they're reliable in their testimony. So these are all problems if we rely on it as something that, say, is we're going to use it to replace the forms of, I guess, the forms of ensuring justice that we normally rely on. And I think there's two reasons why we're seeing the rise of cancel culture right now. One is, of course, just the popularity and the availability of social media, where people can, you know, anybody can give voice in a public forum.
And others can pile on.
Right. So that makes it real easy to do. But the second is we have a low trust culture right now. We've had 30 years of consistent decline in levels of public trust in our major institutions. And this includes our schools and universities, businesses, courts, our laws, our churches. What happens in a society in which there is low trust is people don't turn to the institutions to correct what they perceive as social problems. They take matters into their own hands. And what that looked like, say, back in the 18th or 19th century, we had things like tarring and feathering that happened on a regular basis. You know, people would just grab somebody out of their house who was accused of doing something that was offensive to the social order. They would take them out, strip them, pour tar over them and pour feathers, and then set them on a fence rail and take them out of town, which is...
That'd make a heck of an Instagram post.
Well, yeah, I mean... And this happened with frequency, but then you'd also have beatings and whippings, and you had lynchings. And these were always perceived by the people who engaged in them as the administration of justice. And yet we know for a fact that oftentimes innocent people were accused or people were subjected to types of punishment that were far in excess of any crime or offense that they had committed. And that is the problem. Cancel culture doesn't do anything so violent, but it is just as vicious. If you look at the comments that are made in many cases against people, there's some real anger and hatred directed at folks right now.
Pew Research Center has done a couple of polls on this topic. And I guess, surprisingly or not, I'm not sure, but it seems like so many issues in our country are split close to 50-50. This poll found a couple of things. One, that more people are aware of the phrase cancel culture than a year or two before. That shouldn't surprise anybody. But the poll also found that 51% of U.S. adults say calling out others on social media is more likely to hold people accountable, and 45%, just a small bit less, say it's more likely to punish people who don't deserve it. And it's interesting, although it's close to a 50-50 split, and we're so used to talking about our politics in near 50-50 splits, I don't get the sense that this necessarily falls down political lines. Do you think I'm right?
No, I don't think it does, although my sense is people who lean Republican are more likely to think that it punishes people unfairly than the people who lean liberal.
Okay.
That's kind of my sense, but I'm not sure about that. I think that, you know, those who think that it's more likely to hold people accountable are just wrong. It does hold certain individuals accountable, but, you know, it's so arbitrary. You can take many individual cases and you say, okay, we feel really good about this case. You know, this person did something terrible. They really deserve what's coming to them. And, you know, and what's the matter? First of all, I don't like it that it's always the most extreme thing. We rush quickly from somebody did something wrong to demanding their firing.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than to say, you know, a suspension or, you know, something like that. It's always the most extreme. The other thing is that whenever we do this, whenever we put these really strong demands on the most extreme solutions, what we do is we deprive our institutions of the power of taking due process to hold people accountable the way we really want if we want to ensure justice, because it's only institutions that are going to make sure there's some kind of consistent delivery of accountability. Because everybody who, you know, of all the individuals who are picked out in social media, there's a whole bunch of others that get away with all kinds of nasty stuff in the world. And in general, it's only our institutions that end up holding the majority of people accountable for their bad behaviors. And so if we abandon our institutions in favor of a cancel culture where we pick out wrongdoing on a case-by-case basis, what we're basically saying is most people get to do, you know, all kinds of bad things. We're just going to be happy with getting vengeance against a few.
There was an article by Insider.com, and we'll certainly link to it in the show notes, but there was basically talking about some of the same things you just touched on, about being critical in many ways of cancel culture. And some of the bullet points it pointed out in the article was, one, that it encourages shame and not accountability. And we've talked about shame on this show before, and I think I tried to make the point once that shaming someone does at some ways work. And I think you push back on that a bit. Am I remembering that right? And how does shaming someone ever seem like the right thing to do, at least in a very public way?
Shaming can be quite effective at changing a person's outward behavior.
Okay.
Because you're drawing attention to what is seen.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. Shame is very visual. Guilt is more internal. Guilt has to do with somebody's behavior and whether that, you know, they actually did something that's say a sin or a transgression or a violation of the rules or not. Shame is just about whether they are seen to do something.
And just to tease that out a little more, and it's funny, it showed up on my Facebook timeline just a couple of days ago because I captured the moment after it happened on my Facebook page, and we talked about it also here on the show. But it was, again, 2 years ago, that would have been November 2020. This is pre-vaccines, the COVID's in not a great place. And I was shopping at a grocery store that was mandating masks. Everybody in the store had a mask on, but one shopper. And at the end of my shopping trip, I went to the customer service desk where they were selling masks for $1, purchased one and handed it to her and made a bit of a production of it. Basically saying that everybody else is wearing a mask. I think you need to wear one too. And I thought I was trying to shame her into good behavior. I don't think I was trying to cancel her. So we're getting maybe a bit off topic. But in that case, I think you pointed out that I was just, if I remember how you phrased this, making her believe all the worst things about people who are pro-mask.
Yeah, so the problem of shame is that it is so superficial. So it's no accident that we have the rise of the term virtue signaling mm-hmm. along with cancel culture. Cancel culture is about shaming. Virtue signaling is the thing about like showing how good your behavior is. And then in a way demanding that others participate in the same kind of performances. But it's all performance. It's not internal. And what I find really interesting about so much of the cancel culture stuff is that at the same time that there's this condemnation of somebody's behavior or past behavior, there's a real insistence that they show sincere remorse, that they participate in what's sometimes called like a process of healing and forgiveness. We want them to show that they do all this internal work. And yet, because it's all performative, there's no showing that can count, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're still hanging on to these old ideas of whether somebody actually feels guilty that they really did it or not. And they don't work together. You can't demand a performance and then also require that the performance be sincere. I mean, it's these are just kind of contradictory things.
The article I mentioned that was somewhat critical of cancel culture also pointed out that this process can backfire because the canceled person might double down on the claim that got them canceled and might even be more empowered with more public support as a result. And again, I'm not going to spend this whole time talking about my interaction with this maskless shopper in a grocery store 2 years ago, but in some ways I think it applies here too, because I don't, in looking back on that in 2 years later, I can't imagine that interaction with this woman made her sit back and reflect and say, gosh, maybe next time I go to the supermarket, I'll wear a mask. It may well have made her more calcified in her views. And I think this article, pivoting back to cancel culture, says much the same thing, that if people are just piled upon for their supposed bad behavior, that it's likely going to solidify their positions even more so.
Yeah, it is. So, and what often happens is people are piled upon, but there's no opportunity to make amends, right? And like this is the case with Mitchell Miller.
Yeah,
like there's nothing he can do. Like the commissioner of the NHL said he is not eligible to play in the NHL at this time. I can't say that he'll ever be eligible. Well, what does that mean? It's like, well, it means, I think what it means is that they can't state terms of his reinstatement to the NHL because he didn't actually violate any league rules or policies. Mm-hmm. I mean, what he did is he caused moral outrage. And so he can be reinstated when he stops causing moral outrage. Well, that was something he did 6 years ago that caused not anything he's doing now. So there's nothing he can do. Well, it's understandable then that this causes a certain kind of resentment that I'm banned because of something I did in the past that I'm no longer doing. There's no accusations that I've did it at all in the last 6 years. So how am I supposed to respond to this? I mean, that's the sort of thing that causes a backlash against anybody who might then identify with somebody who's targeted in this way.
But couldn't some people say that, yeah, this is too bad for Mitchell Miller, and it may not, his hockey career may never become a hockey career. But because of this, some might think that other young men and possibly young women who are looking at a future in athletics, even in middle school, and say to themselves, gosh, maybe I need to be more careful and measured about my actions. And if this means that even a handful of fewer kids in classrooms across this country are not treated like this, I mean, is that a possible good outcome of this, or is that just connecting too many dots?
No, it's actually... It's one of the reasons why this sort of thing ends up being counterproductive. Like, I think most people would believe that there's way too much bullying and harassment that goes on, say, in middle schools and high schools. We should do much more as a society to stop it. And too often, teachers and the coaches in the past, and I probably still do, will turn a blind eye to star players that are engaging in bad behavior. That's not a good thing. So we want to do something that will make that happen less. Well, what is the lesson that comes down then from the NHL? Well, you better not get caught. We have a player who's been engaging in harassment. You know, he's a really, you know, a dumb 11-year-old who's been doing this. We better not bring him up for any disciplinary charges because that's going to go on his record. It might affect his whole career. So let's hide it. I mean, what you want is to make everything more transparent. You want to hold people more accountable. This provides an incentive to allow more of the bad conduct, not less.
I see. I don't know, though, because I think we would agree that if you asked 1,000 middle schoolers who are active in sports, how many of you are going to turn pro, you're going to get a much higher number thinking they're going to turn pro than ever will. I mean, the number is tiny, and we know that because that's just how it works. But couldn't you see smart parents or coaches saying, hey, Billy, you need to stop. You need to knock that off because I know one day you want to play for the NBA or Major League Baseball or whoever, and they're not going to – they could find out about this, and that is going to put a stop to it. Hey, you don't believe me? Let me tell you about this kid named Mitchell. And the vast majority of those kids may not even play college sports, but – in some ways, I could see where this might make them think twice.
Nope.
Okay.
Because they're middle school kids, they're not engaging in long-term reasoning. They're basically short-term thinkers. So if you say, you do that, you're not playing this week.
Mm-hmm.
That will have an impact. Okay. Like, you do that again, we're bringing you up on hearing. You know, and we're going to put you through this hearing and you're going to be involved in some kind of penalty or, you know, probation from the team, whatever it is, that sort of thing. That's going to have an impact. But saying, you know, like, you know, 10 years from now, you might not get to play on this team if somebody finds out about it. Well,
there's, you know, just, yeah, it seems like forever.
Yeah. I mean, human beings generally aren't very good at that kind of long-term thinking, but especially kids. And so, what's more likely to happen, that the adults who are engaged in doing this are going to be more likely to cover it up because it's going to bring real embarrassment to their own institution, to their own coaching practices, to all these things, or that they're going to be more open and transparent about it? I think it's an incentive to cover things up.
And the last point that this article made, again, sort of picking apart the dangers of cancel culture, is that process by those who instigate it, they're often driven more by entertainment than accountability, meaning that this is sort of fun. Like, how can we bring this person down quickly and watch all the comments in the thread and oh, we just found out where he works. Oh my gosh, we just found out his home address. Oh my gosh, we just found out, you know, all these things. And you just sort of, it turns into more of a game than it does truly being concerned about this person's actions. And I think that's a fair criticism.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's that entertainment aspect to it. I think there's also sometimes a great deal of sincerity in the amount of empathy one might have for the victim of that harassment. If you read these cases, there's some graphic descriptions of what Miller did to this classmate, you know, putting a piece of candy and rubbing in a urinal and making him lick it, those sorts of things. So you read a description like that, and if you were ever subjected to bullying behavior like that, you have an immediate empathy for the victim of that, and you have a kind of visceral kind of hatred or antagonism toward a person who would do such a thing. And so then you're likely to pile on and think also that that you're right to pile on. That's really awful behavior. But it much of it comes from an empathy arising from our own experience, bad experiences in middle school. That can be quite sincere, but again, there's no proportionality or due process here. You go immediately, just from a description about somebody that you really know nothing about, and in a case where you don't have any standing or have any long-term interest, to immediate judgment and then action.
Before we close this topic, I wanted to just touch on something related, I think. I wasn't able to find it, but I remember there was an article I read, I don't know, it was a year or two ago, by a well-respected music writer. And his angle was that he was always a fan of Michael Jackson's music, and he just finds it difficult to listen to now because of all the things we know about him now. And the other thing, and this was just in the last 24 hours or so, we've talked on the show probably more often than people want to hear me talk about baseball, but there was just a simple post on a Facebook page about Kirby Puckett, who was an outfielder for the Minnesota Twins in the his best years were in the late 80s and early 90s, and he hit an amazing home run in Game 6 of the 1991 World Series that, if you're a Twins fan, was one of the best moments in the history of the team. And I was curious because I knew the show was coming up and there were a lot of comments. And I started clicking through all of them and people would say things like, that was a great game. He was a great player. He was one of my favorite Twins players. A couple people even said they had a chance to meet him and said what a great guy he was. But nobody mentioned that, and this was, I should point out that Kirby Puckett had, I think it was a glaucoma or some eye disease that forced him out of the game early. I think he would have gone on to play many more years. And in those years, and he was caught up in some shenanigans with his wife. They had a very nasty divorce, all sorts of things that sort of did not make him look like this iconic squeaky clean image that a lot of people had. And also, unfortunately, he died way too young. But and there have been plenty of stories written about sort of the after playing days of Kirby Puckett in really not glowing terms at all. And not one person mentioned that. And I was surprised, and I wasn't going to be the guy who was going to, but it seemed like because that was maybe a different time, Kirby Puckett, certainly among this group of baseball fans, had not been canceled. He was remembered for that Game 6 heroic home run, and I just found that interesting and maybe the product of a different time. So I guess, you know, maybe the question to you is, how do we judge people who are no longer with us, whether it be sports figures or entertainers, whether it be Michael Jackson's music or Roman Polanski, who was very credibly accused of, or was he convicted? I think may have been convicted.
I'm not sure.
But I'll look up, but at least credibly accused of raping a girl at the kind of the height of his career. And should you feel okay about watching one of his films? Should you feel okay about listening to Michael Jackson's music? How do you sort of think about those things?
I think it's really hard to have the same kind of opinion of somebody and their artistic works after you hear something that's very disturbing about them. If it's minor, the sort of thing that friends of yours might do and that you might chastise them for, that's one thing. But if it's something that's pretty shameful, I mean, look at what's happened to Woody Allen. A lot of people just said they can't watch Woody Allen movies anymore. And I think that's perfectly understandable. I felt that kind of unease watching Roman Polanski movies.
Yeah.
I don't see
him
out.
And he's never on screen even.
No.
Thanks to our Wikipedia entry, just so we're clear on his situation. In 1977, when Polanski was 43, he was arrested and charged in Los Angeles with 6 offenses against a 13-year-old girl. He pled guilty to some of the charges, but then thinking he was likely to face prison, he then became a fugitive and has mostly lived in France since then. So that is his sort of what's happened. That's been, and he's still, I believe, still alive.
Well, there's a difference between like somebody being lowered in your estimation, and so you regard their works differently, and you might choose, say, not to listen to their music or not to watch their films. That's entirely different from getting on social media and demanding that they be fired, or demanding that, say, all the movies be removed from
Spotify or Netflix,
or Netflix or something like this. I mean, that's the sort of thing that's happened to Joe Rogan, for example.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's not just that people say, well, I don't want to listen to Joe Rogan anymore. It's that they say, we demand that he be removed from Spotify or I'm canceling my account.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where it goes too far. And I understand somebody not liking somebody's behavior and said, I don't want to support them. Even if I'm not supporting them financially anymore, the case of Roman Polanski, I just don't feel like watching his movies. It just, I don't feel good about it.
By the way,
I have a Kirby Puckett story.
Please go right ahead.
My uncle used to sell baseball cards and other sports memorabilia, and he would go around to different shows and fairs and things. And he was at one big sports show in the Twin Cities just a couple years after Kirby Puckett had retired, and he had some photographs of Kirby Puckett that were framed that he was selling along with, you know, trading cards and things. Kirby Puckett walked up, introduced himself, and then say, I'll take this one and this one and this one, and picked up three or four items off the table and walked away.
Without paying?
Without paying.
Huh.
And without saying anything about it. And my uncle's view was that he thought, well, because my uncle was profiting off of his image and so forth, Puckett was entitled to it, and he may have. But it left a bad impression. When I was told that story, it left a really bad impression. And like Kirby Puckett at the time, I had really high regard for him. And after that, I thought, he's just an ordinary person like everybody else, and he has his flaws, and maybe I shouldn't elevate, you know, sports stars to that kind of platform that I really regard them highly. I might admire their performance, but, you know, I don't know anything about what they're like as a person.
And this incident, I'm guessing, happened in the 1990s probably sometime.
Yeah.
So, you know, if this were to have happened last week, would there be any part of you who would have thought, geez, and we'll just pretend Kirby is still with us, that you would have gone on Facebook or something and said, oh, let me tell you all a story?
Absolutely. I mean, it's so easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on how angry I was. But there's also, like, how many people might like hearing that?
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty juicy rumor right there, you know.
But you would not have said, again, if you were still with us and still, let's say, working as a Minnesota Twins first base coach, you would not be clamoring for him to be fired.
No. I am so, at this point, I'm so disgusted with what is happening with our cancel culture that I stay out of all of that. I never jump on the bandwagon in those kinds of demands. I think it's really important that we commit ourselves to doing the hard work of making sure that our institutions, whether these are businesses or government agencies or churches, whether that we do the hard work of ensuring that they become more transparent, more fair, more accountable to people. That's really, that takes some engagement. It takes patience. It takes real attention to detail. And you've got to be in it for the long haul. It's not just jumping on and shooting off some remarks. But that's the way we make society better. We're not going to make society better by piling on Twitter or Facebook.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, here is my question for you. You and your family take a week-long vacation. You stay at hotels, dine in restaurants, and see many attractions. You had a great time. And you often use services such as Yelp and TripAdvisor to plan where to go and sometimes where not to go. Now that you're back from your trip, do you feel obligated to leave your own reviews on such sites so you can provide that same guidance that you relied on to others?
That's really interesting. You know, when I use services like Airbnb, where I have some kind of relationship with the host, mm-hmm. you know, and it's a little more personal, I always feel obligated to leave a review. And in part because there's usually not a lot of reviews, and the people who are hosts really depend on those reviews, and people read them and look at them for their business. But when it comes to like Yelp or TripAdvisor, even though I use them occasionally, I don't feel obligated, partly because there's just so many of them.
So many reviews usually.
And also, so I guess it doesn't even occur to me, frankly. Mm-hmm. I probably ought to do that once in a while. I think especially when I have a good experience. I think people are much more inclined to leave a review when they have a really bad experience than to leave a positive review.
A couple of thoughts on this. What you just said was, you know, more people are more often to leave a bad experience than a good experience. I find it amazing anymore where, and this is only primarily for national things, but I happened to be at a hotel this past weekend. It was a Hilton property. Perfectly fine stay. But then when you get back, you know, a day later, there is an email wanting your input on the stay. You'll get that even from restaurants, from when you go to the clinic, you'll often get, how was your interaction with your doctor? And all these things. And obviously, these companies are trying to collect data to measure how well they're doing. But I think you're exactly right. I think in many cases, you know, like my hotel, I did fill out the hotel stay. And I said perfectly nice things. But, you know, had I been busy when the email came, I probably would have just given it a pass. But I'll tell you, if there was something that was really wrong, mm-hmm. I would have been much more likely to fill it out. So I guess point one is I'm not sure how reliable the data those companies are collecting is, because when people are much more likely to share negative things than positive things.
What about the reliability of the comments though that are in the review? So not just the number of stars, like mm-hmm. if they get 4.5, but if you read through like a selection of the comments and you see some positive ones and some negatives, are those more reliable, do you think?
I mean, maybe you mentioned Airbnb, and I think what they do is smart though, because one, you're right, there is a bit more of a, you know, you're dealing with it in many cases, not every case, but a person, not a corporation. But what is smart is that not only do you get the chance to review them, the owner gets a chance to review you. So, and that Airbnb does not make those viewable until you've each filled out your review, which I think is actually really smart because it promotes more people to do that. And I think every time, I probably stayed in an Airbnb 15 times, I think every time I've left a review because of that, because I'm always curious to see what they say about me, and never has it been anything all that interesting, but I'm always curious.
You know, now that you say that, I'm thinking the last several times that I've had a bad experience at a hotel, it's always been because of other guest behavior, not because of anything the hotel has done. You know, people partying till 4 a.m. in the hallway or, you know, something mm-hmm. like that. So that's interesting. I think hotels and many restaurants are trying harder and harder to ensure that they take care of any potential bad experiences because they don't want the negative review.
Well, and I've even seen, I don't know if it's in restaurants or hotels or maybe both, where a sign will be up, I think I've seen, where it'll say, if you have something great to share, be sure to share it widely. If you have a problem with your stay, please tell us immediately one-on-one. Which is an interesting message to send, mm-hmm. but obviously, you could expand this whole thing to when you buy on Amazon or other e-commerce sites. I mean, you're always, not always, but you often check what people are saying about a product that you're going to drop some money on. And I think as a society, we've become so reliable, or we rely so much on these opinions of others. That's why I was just curious what ethical responsibility we have to share our thoughts about our experiences.
I think in general, if there's a service that we rely upon, we should feel compelled or some obligation to support that in some way. in the case of reviews, the only way to really to do that is to offer reviews ourselves. So to be reciprocal, if we're benefiting from others' behavior, we should be willing to do the same thing.
But if you go to two restaurants and restaurant number one had great service and you just can't wait to go home and tell everybody what a great independent restaurant, the food was great, the service was great, and you type out, you know, four sentences that just said it's the best place you've ever been. And then the next night you have the opposite experience at another place, are you going to be just as eager to fill that out?
Well, what you want to do really is give the bad review to the good place so it won't be so crowded the next time, and then give the good review to the bad place so more people go there. But, well, I'm just kidding.
We'll end this on a thing that I'm going to get in so much trouble for.
Okay.
Years ago, Travis and I were at a hotel in, I'm not going to say where, and it was one of these, I'd never been in a hotel that had this. It was kind of cool. They had a big pool, and half of it was indoor, and there was like a wall, and if you swam under the water, you'd be outdoors. And mm-hmm. that was kind of a cool thing. So one morning, I was sleeping in, and he decided to go down to the pool and just get some swimming in. And he was in the, it was a chillier morning, so he was in the indoor part. And he looked outside, and in the outdoor part, there was a rat in the pool. And it was still swimming. I mean, it was like alive, but it was in the pool. So he got out of the pool and went and told somebody at the front desk that there is a rat in the pool, and they got the rat out of the pool. But that was sort of the end of his time in the pool that day. Nothing wrong so far, right? But then
I don't know. I think that was it.
Well,
but they handled it.
They
okay.
handled it fine. So then I go, and this is probably a long time ago, but I go to the front desk and say, "So you heard there was a rat in the pool? Yeah, we heard about that." I said, "Well, you know, I'd hate to have that show up on a review somewhere. Anything you can do to make that right?" And they gave me a nice $50 gift card to the restaurant that evening. Was that the wrong thing to do?
You are just shameless.
But I mean, I'm sure they're thinking that it was true. I wasn't making something up.
Right.
And having a rat in the pool was not something they wanted showing up on their page. And it was worth $50 to shut me up.
Yeah. And it seems like maybe it's not technically blackmail, but it seems to come pretty close.
Well, the good news for everybody is this is before we started the Ethical Life podcast. And I have become so much more ethical. I would never do such a thing today.
And that is why people should listen.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Chris Lay is Lee's podcast operation manager. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And be sure to check out Rick's column about cancel culture on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.